Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's a lot of women that's coming out, you know, and expressing themselves about what happened to them.
I really hope the Me Too movement is propelling us in that direction where assaulting people has consequences.
I think it's important that we listen to all of the women that are coming out and telling their stories and work on how we can engage them in a healing process.
The Me Too movement has led many people to share their experiences with sexual harassment and sexual assault. It has sparked conversations and controversy and maybe even change. I'm Charity Nebbe. Look for Unsettled, Mapping Me Too, a new podcast from Iowa Public Radio in the iTunes Store and on Google Play, or find it at iowapublicradio.org. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, Susan Craig has been working at the Iowa City Public Library since 1977. She's been director since 1994. She is now retiring. I'll talk with her about her long career and how she's seen the library evolve during that time. But first, living with and treating cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is a progressive genetic disease that causes persistent lung infections and makes it harder and harder to breathe over time. It causes a sticky buildup of mucus in the lungs, but also in the pancreas and other organs. In a few minutes, Dr. David Stoltz, assistant director of the Adult Cystic Fibrosis Center at the University of Iowa, will be joining us. But first, Elise and Addie Free are here. They live in Des Moines. Addie is 13 years old and was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis when she was 4 months old. And thank you both for being here today.
Thank you.
And Elise, I want to start with you. Take us back in time to that diagnosis. Little infant Addie was 4 months old. What led to her diagnosis?
She was failure to thrive. So she was really tiny, wasn't gaining weight, and she was kind of, I was nursing her all day, and it was like those little baby dolls that you give them a bottle and it just goes right through. She just was not gaining weight. So we went to our pediatrician and expressed concern, and he was kind of the blame the mom. Oh, you're a new mother. This is your first child. And didn't really listen to us. But we ended up finding a fabulous pediatrician who, when we went in, he canceled all of his appointments for the day and said, we're going to figure this out. We're going to get to the bottom of it and see what's going on with her.
Wow. So when you got that diagnosis of cystic fibrosis, do you have a family history? Was this something that you knew anything about?
No family history. And most people don't have a family history of it. It's very rare. Only 30,000 people in the U.S. have it. And I think it's 1 in 30 people are carriers, but even then, you only have a 25% chance of having a kid with CF if both parents are carriers. So it's just, it's rare. It's not something you would, you know, immediately think if your child was not gaining weight.
Right. So, okay, once you did know that she had cystic fibrosis, what does that mean for a baby? How is a baby treated?
Well, she was so malnourished by the time we got the diagnosis. We were in California, and they were not doing newborn screening at the time. Had they, you know, we would have gotten immediate care. Her liver, kidneys, I mean, everything was affected by it because she was getting no nutrients, even though I was feeding her, you know, basically all day long. So when we went into the CF clinic in Hollywood, they immediately put her in the hospital, and she was there for about 3 weeks. She had to have a blood transfusion. It was really scary. There was a time we didn't really know if she was going to make it.
Wow.
Yeah, and they got her on pancreatic enzymes. So this little 3-4 month old having to take their capsules. So you'd break it open, and you're supposed to put them in applesauce, but she wouldn't do that. So we had to find creative ways to get her to take her meds. And taking medicine is something Addie's been doing all of her life. So I know that you stayed in Los Angeles, Addie, until you were about 8 years old, right? And then you moved to Iowa?
Mm-hmm. It was in August, and I was almost nine. My birthday's in September, so I was basically nine.
Can you tell me, Addie, what your treatment is like on a daily basis? Because I know that you have to spend a couple hours every day treating cystic fibrosis.
Yeah, every day, twice a day, I do my machine called the vest, and I put this vest on, and it shakes and it vibrates my lungs. And I also have the nebulizer where I breathe in medicine, and many pills a day. Every time I eat, I have to take my enzymes plus other pills.
Well, and you mentioned taking those enzymes. We think about cystic fibrosis as a lung disease, but Elise, there is a real digestive component of this as well. I mentioned that the mucus also builds up in other organs, including the pancreas. So the digestion is a really serious part of this problem, right?
Yeah, and that's, I mean, knock on wood, her lungs are really healthy. Her issues have been with digestion and just chronic stomach aches. She misses a lot of school because of that. It's just no fun, you know, having a stomach ache every day. And it affects different people. CF affects people differently. So some kids with CF don't even have to take enzymes. They're pancreatic sufficient. She's very pancreatic insufficient, so she takes probably like an adult amount of enzymes to eat, and she has to also consume about the same caloric intake of a grown man to gain weight, because even with the enzymes, you know, it's not the pancreas working at the full.
Right.
You know.
Addie, is that a challenge for you to try to eat enough every day?
Well, I'm a person who doesn't really have a big appetite, so I guess it's a little hard. But I managed to stay okay on weight.
So I know your mom just mentioned that you have to miss a lot of school. How does having cystic fibrosis affect you at school?
Well, when usually I'm kind of late because of my treatments. People are like, Addie, why are you always so late? And they're like, why do you miss so much school? And when I do miss school, I have to take home a lot of work. And it's just kind of a lot.
Yeah, I can imagine. Do you try to educate your teachers and your friends about cystic fibrosis?
Yeah, all my friends know that I have it, and they kind of stand up for me when people are like, why are you always so late? What's wrong with you?
Yeah. Now, I know that getting viruses can be really dangerous for people with cystic fibrosis. Do you have to take precautions to try to protect yourself when other kids have colds and things like that?
Well, I mean, I'm kind of a stickler about germs myself, but why are you laughing?
It's funny.
Okay. But, I mean, I've always had a pretty good immune system. Whenever I get a cold, it always lasts like a few days, and that's kind of it.
Oh, that's very good news. All right, Elise, yeah. I need to hear about this from your perspective, too, though, because I'm sure as a mom, it's really hard to send Addie out into the world where there are germs all over the place. How do you think about that?
I was laughing because every time she comes home from anywhere, she immediately goes in the bathroom and washes her hands. That was, you know, something we set up from, you know, toddlerhood. And at the beginning, I think, you know, I was that crazy parent with the hand wipes and everything at the park and wiping everything down and carts at the grocery store. And, I mean, we live pretty much like everybody else. I've learned that, you know, she needs to be a kid. She plays in the mud. She goes and hangs out with her friends, and I've really tried not to limit her. And the adults that I've met with CF, that's of all the advice, that's what they said. You know, let your kid be a kid. So obviously, if one of her friends has the flu or we know somebody is ill, we stay away. But and our friends and family, everyone knows. And so if there's a dinner or, you know, Christmas or Thanksgiving and somebody's sick, they don't come, you know. So we've been very fortunate to have friends and family who get it and make us aware. I'll get calls, you know, if her friend's parents say, oh, you know, my son tested positive for strep, so be careful, you know, and we've just been really lucky to have great people around us.
You mentioned talking to adults who have cystic fibrosis, and I'm really curious about, this is a rare disease, as you said, and I can only imagine that it can be very isolating to have cystic fibrosis and live with cystic fibrosis. But the internet, of course, has given people access to each other all over the world. Is there a really strong cystic fibrosis community that you've been able to tap into, Elise?
Yeah, and the thing about CF is that people with cystic fibrosis cannot be around each other because of cross-contamination. So it's even more isolating for patients. As far as me as a parent, I have so many friends that are CF parents and in the community and adults with CF. And that's been huge, not only for community, but, you know, reaching out if something's going on with Addie, and I can immediately get online and contact thousands of people and say, you know, has your kid ever had this? And what should we do? And what should we ask our doctors? Addie hasn't quite gotten, like, online with other CF kids, but I think that as she gets older, she probably will.
Addie, does it feel lonely to have cystic fibrosis, something that other people in your life just don't have to think about?
Not really for me, but I guess for other people it could, but I don't really, it's not a big issue for me. And I don't really care about contacting other people with CF. I mean, it just doesn't interest me because I can't actually see them in real life.
Right. I can understand. So I am curious, there are people who have developed an online presence communicating about cystic fibrosis. And in fact, we just lost one of those people, YouTube star Claire Wineland, who was a very strong advocate for people with cystic fibrosis, and she passed away this fall. Elise, is that contact a little bit of a double-edged sword when you lose such a strong personality like that?
Yeah, I can, I can barely talk about Claire because it was so devastating. And I just, when I got on my computer that day, you know, I was just sobbing, and Addie came in and said, what's wrong? And, you know, it's heartbreaking,
yeah,
to see people so young, and especially somebody so full of life, pass away so quickly.
And she was only 21 years old. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we're talking about living with cystic fibrosis. Addie and Elise Free of Des Moines are here. Addie is 13 years old and was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis when she was 4 months old. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're talking about living with and treating cystic fibrosis. Elise and Addie Free of Des Moines are here with me. Addie is 13 years old and lives with cystic fibrosis. Elise is her mother. And I also want to bring somebody else into the conversation now. Dr. David Stoltz is assistant director of the Adult Cystic Fibrosis Center at the University of Iowa, and he is here with me now. Dr. Stoltz, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And give me a little bit of an idea. In studying adult cystic fibrosis, this is a fairly new field because treatment has advanced to the point where a lot of people with CF are living into adulthood.
It has. You know, when we think of cystic fibrosis, we typically think of it as being traditionally as a disease of children. Back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, kids with CF would live months to years of their life. Actually, a couple of years ago, we now reached an important milestone for CF in that over 50% of people living with CF are in fact adults. And so we're very excited about that. And that's obviously great news for people with CF.
Now, I gave a thumbnail sketch of what cystic fibrosis is earlier, but tell us a little bit more about this disease.
It was very good. It described it nicely. So cystic fibrosis is a genetic disease, meaning that you inherit it, and it's caused by mutations in a gene termed CFTR. CFTR is an anion channel or a pore in cells that moves salt in and out of cells. And when you have abnormal function of this channel, you get, as you described, buildup of mucus secretions in different organs. The lungs are also very prone to infection. And so it's a since it's a genetic disease, people who are affected by CF are born with it.
All right. And there is no cure.
We currently do not have a cure, although we've seen some exciting new therapies in the past couple of years.
Well, let's talk about some of those advancements, because things have been changing pretty dramatically.
So as you heard Addie and her mom describe, you know, a lot of the treatments for CF have really focused on the symptoms. So CF is a complex, chronic, multi-system disease, and all of our treatments traditionally have focused on the symptoms of the disease or the secondary consequences. So for example, in the lungs, we know they're chronically infected with bacteria, so we would treat that with antibiotics, but we're not really fixing the disease. In the pancreas, you heard described, where we have abnormalities there, you would give pancreatic enzyme replacement therapy, but again, not targeting the underlying defect in CF. And as you also heard, these therapies have an enormous time commitment. So typically hours of a day people are spent using these treatments. However, now we have drugs that really arose from strong partnerships and commitments from patients and their families who are incredibly dedicated to the clinical trials in CF. The researchers that have been working on CF and clinicians, as well as funding from sources such as the NIH and the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, we now have this new class of drugs called CFTR modulators. And so instead of treating the secondary consequences of CF, these CFTR modulators actually treat the underlying defect. So we talked about CFTR being this channel or pore in cells that's normally turned off. These drugs actually turn CFTR on and increase its function. They come in a pill form, so they're typically one pill twice a day. The first class of drugs that were approved in 2012 and work in about 4 to 5% of the CF population. We've now had the second generation of drugs come along, which treat even more people with CF. And we're very excited to hear just recently this past month what they're calling the next generation of drugs is probably going to treat upwards of 80 to 90% of people with CF.
Wow.
Want to point out it's not a cure,
right?
But it's actually treating the underlying defect.
And is there exploration into gene therapy? I mean, this is a genetic disorder. Is this something that potentially we could find a cure for?
I think this would be a disease where we probably will see a cure ultimately, which could come from strategies like gene therapy. The gene for cystic fibrosis was identified in 1989. And it was thought shortly thereafter that this would be an ideal disease that gene therapy may work for. In fact, some of the first studies, the human gene therapy trials for CF, were conducted here at the University of Iowa. And they showed that it worked, but it just wasn't long lasting. And so, you know, one of the problems is you develop an immune response, which basically sort of gets rid of the gene therapy. So that's an area of active research. And I think if we're going to go towards a cure, that's going to be one of the key approaches.
Well, and Elise mentioned that at the time that Addie was born in California, they didn't have newborn screening. Newborn screening has gotten much more common. How common is it to do that?
So newborn screening is now present in all 50 states. Okay. And, so about 70% or probably more of the new diagnoses of CF are, in fact, diagnosed with newborn screening. And this is really important because we know that the earlier we treat CF, the better outcomes we have. And so whether it's antibiotics for lung infections, whether it's these new CFTR modulators, the sooner we get these treatments started, the better people will do.
All right. And Elise and Addie's story shows that even 4 months can be
a very long time to not have this disease diagnosed.
Correct. Yep.
And Elisa, I want to ask you, you're listening to the doctor talk about these advances in treatment, and it sounds like it is a really exciting time in research for cystic fibrosis. How does that affect you at this point? I mean, I know that it takes a long time for new treatments to actually become available for patients.
I mean, it's really probably the best time. It's never a good time to have CF, but right now there's just so much. It gives everybody a lot of hope. I think in the CF community, cure is kind of a four-letter word in that you have to be really careful because since Addie's had CF for 13 years, there was so much talk about the cure and it's going to be in. When she was born, one of the nurses said, you know, by the time she's five, there's going to be a cure. And I remember her fifth birthday party and her blowing out candles and thinking, you know, we're not there yet. And so it's a really exciting time, and the CF Foundation is probably one of the best nonprofits. They are incredibly intelligent in how they conduct research, and I just can't say enough about them as a mom, and so grateful.
The when in, you know, talking nuts and bolts of getting treatment for your daughter, do you have difficulty, for example, with your insurance company to get some of these treatments for her?
Yeah, I could probably, everybody that knows me, mm-hmm. Addie is actually giving me a very funny look right now because I talk about this a lot.
Yep.
It is really hard. You know, her medications are incredibly expensive. One of them a month is $8,000. Another one is $6,000. That's just a month. And those are medications for her to eat and breathe. So there have been times where, many times, with insurance companies where, you know, basically every year we get denied for procedures and medications, and I have to spend, you know, hours and hours and hours on the phone trying to get these meds for her and explaining, you know, she needs this to live. This isn't like a cold medication, you know. And yeah, it's my other part-time job.
How successful have you been in those fights? I mean, it sounds like you have been winning them, although they've taken an enormous amount of your time.
Yeah, I'm a squeaky wheel, so I get it done. And sometimes it's just talking to basically everybody at that company until somebody says, okay, we'll approve this. Now that we're at Blank in Des Moines,
Children's Hospital.
Yeah, our nurse care manager is amazing, and she's really done so much. You know, I'll call her and say, Amy, I'm, you know, having a hard time with this insurance or this, and she gives them a call and she gets stuff done too. So it takes a village.
Yeah. Well, it makes you think about, I mean, clearly you are a person who has the resources, the personal resources to advocate for your daughter. It makes you think about people who maybe don't have those resources.
Yeah, I can't imagine if, you know, English was a, you know, not my first language, or it's so difficult for everyone. You know, I don't know anyone that has CF or has a child with CF that is like, oh yeah, it's a breeze getting those treatments, getting those meds. You know, it's difficult for everybody.
Now, when you hear about these new developments and new drugs, do you feel like that's something that you will have access to?
I sure hope so. I mean, the CF Foundation's also good, too, about advocating and getting those drugs to the patients that need it. And obviously our care center, they stay on top of it and any new medications that she might benefit from. The price scares me because obviously insurance companies don't want to pay $250,000 a year to, that's basically what Addie's healthcare is right now. As a healthy child with CF, it's about $250,000. So these new medications that are coming out are going to be very expensive, and I think it's always going to be a battle.
And Dr. Stoltz, Elise was mentioning the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, and before we started the show, you mentioned to me how extraordinary this organization is. Give me a little bit of an idea. I mean, obviously, most diseases have their foundations now. What makes the CF Foundation so powerful?
Yeah, so the CF Foundation has been around for a while now, and was in fact started by, you know, families and parents of kids with CF who wanted to make sure that we had a strong focus and emphasis on developing new treatments for their children. It now has really been instrumental in supporting and allowing for the development of many of these new treatments. The CF Foundation developed this model of what they call venture philanthropy, where they pair with both academics and universities, as well as pharmaceutical companies and industry, and then the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation as well, to help develop these new treatments. They also have a huge number of resources that help people with CF, you know, whether it's ensuring that they have access to medications, helping them get into, you know, college, providing them resources to help with that, or maybe providing resources as they go on to develop a family. And so they've been, as pointed out, incredibly helpful for people with CF, and have really become a model nonprofit organization for other diseases to follow.
Well, in so many ways, this generation of adults with cystic fibrosis is the first generation of adults with cystic fibrosis to really pioneer what it's like to live as an adult with cystic fibrosis beyond eating and breathing, which are the main challenges for people with CF. What are some of the challenges that you see people, adults with CF, facing?
So a lot of it has to, I think, do with, where do they go, once they become adults? You know, do they go to college? Do they go to university? What types of jobs do they have? Can they maintain a job full time? We have a number of our adults with CF who are married, have families. And it's sort of amazing to think about, some of these people may have grandchildren, which not that long ago, that would be something that we didn't even discuss.
Right.
Another area we think about is, as they get older, we have to begin to think about other things like, for example, cancer screening. So that was something that we never even thought about before when people weren't living as long. And so it's created some new questions, if you will, but we're happy to answer them.
Absolutely.
Because this is really important.
So much has changed even in the last 10 years. Let's look ahead 5-10 years. What do you see changing in treatment for CF?
So I think as these new CFTR modulators come on board, we're going to see how that really changes the disease. So the first one that was approved in 2012 is now approved down to 1 year of age. So if you have a certain mutation in CFTR, you can start this drug at 1 year of age. And so how that is going to change the long-term outcome, I don't think we know yet, but it's clearly going to have an impact. I think another important thing is the treatment burden. So again, a couple hours a day having to take these different therapies, we have to figure out how can we minimize that. And with these new other CFTR modulator treatments, we may be able to decrease some of these other therapies and find out that we don't need them. And then I think, again, we have to, think about adults and, what resources are we going to need for adults? Because, again, traditionally, this was mainly a disease of kids.
Yeah. Addie, what do you want, everybody listening right now, what do you want us to know about cystic fibrosis?
Well, I don't really know.
What do you wish the kids at school knew or your teachers knew that you didn't have to tell them?
Just not to bug me about it all the time.
You're not defined by this, are you?
Mm-mm. I don't think about it.
Really?
Mm-mm.
So when you think about the future, what are you most excited about, Addie?
going to college and starting my career as an animal behaviorist.
Fantastic. That's a great plan. And Elise, what do you want everybody to know about cystic fibrosis?
Well, I really want everybody to get online right now and make a donation to the CF Foundation. I think Addie said it perfectly. I mean, it's, you know, she has cystic fibrosis, but it doesn't have us. And we're going to live each day and live our lives with it, but also just enjoying our lives and not letting it stop us.
You're acting like I'm going to die.
I'm not.
Are you guys excited about the 5 Feet Apart movie that's coming out this spring? I know that some people think that it's going to be a great thing for cystic fibrosis and some people don't. It's a cystic fibrosis romance. What do you think?
I've heard, I was online and kind of following some chatting within the CF community. And I think I'm not going to judge until I see it because... you know, I think bringing awareness to cystic fibrosis is fantastic. And for more people just to see what daily life is like, I mean, will be great and great for hopefully raising money for the foundation too.
Well, Elise Free, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Addie, thank you. I hear you have a math test today, so good luck on that. And I hope that when you are an animal behaviorist, you'll come back on the show and tell me about your research, okay?
Thank you.
All right. Addie Free of Des Moines and Dr. David Stoltz, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. David Stoltz, Assistant Director of the Adult Cystic Fibrosis Center at the University of Iowa. We've been talking about living with and treating cystic fibrosis. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Susan Craig was hired as a full-time librarian at the Iowa City Public Library in 1977, and she never left. She became the director of the library in 1994, and now, after a 41-year career at the library, longer if you count some part-time work she did before 1977, she is retiring. We thought this was a perfect moment to look back over her career and talk about how she's seen her library and other libraries evolve over that time. Susan, thank you so much for being here.
Well, it's great to be here, and thank you for asking.
Yeah, congratulations.
I'm looking forward to retirement. People say, well, are you anxious? Are you not? No, it's just ready for the next phase. But I have loved working in libraries, and particularly the Iowa City Public Library.
Let's go back in time. You grew up in Waterloo, right?
I grew up in Waterloo. My first job, real job, other than, as I tell people nowadays, I remember ironing my uncle's shirts for a quarter apiece and babysitting for 50 cents an hour. And we don't do that anymore. Nobody irons, and babysitting is a lot more than 50 cents an hour.
I hope, yeah.
As anyone who's paying it today knows. My first real job was at the Waterloo Public Library shelving books when I was 14 years old, and I'm 66 now, so I've been working in libraries for 52 years. That doesn't sound right. Yes, that's right, isn't it? 52 years. Whew. I am a reader. I've been a reader since I learned to read at a very young age. I lived about 5 blocks away from the East Side branch of the Waterloo Public Library. It was one of the first places I got to go by myself. You know, I could tell you the books on the shelves, you know, the librarians' names. Miss Kelly, you know, would give me books to read. So I have always been a reader and loved reading and libraries.
What brought you to the Iowa City Public Library? Were you always certain you were going to be a librarian?
I was not. I came to Iowa City to get an undergraduate degree, and my undergraduate degree is in history and political science. At the time, I thought I was going to go to law school, and it was I got accepted to law school, and I had just recently been married, and I went to talk to them. We didn't have a lot of money, you know, and I said, well, how about going to law school part-time? And they just looked at me aghast and said, no, you don't go to law school part-time. And it was sort of the Watergate era, and lawyers were not held in high esteem, and I thought, you know what? I got a great fallback. I'm going to be a librarian, And I'm going to be happy doing that the rest of my life. And that's what I went to library school instead. And I've never regretted it.
And you actually did work study at the Iowa City Public Library.
Yes. January of 1975, when I started library school, I had a work study job there. And my work study job was filing catalog cards. In the catalog, for anyone who can remember that, I'm sure many of our listeners can. You know, I was qualified to file catalog cards because I was a library school student, and there was an entire book about the rules. You know, this is before computers, and computers file everything for us now, and we just have to get used to the way computers do it. Back in the day, the American Library Association had an entire book about how you determine. You spelled out the numbers. You filed the MCs and the MACs together. You know, how you dealt with, you know, apostrophes in a name. It was a whole book on how to alphabetize, basically.
And, of course, every new book needed a new card. And
yes, yes, yeah.
So you obviously loved libraries. You really fell in love in particular with the Iowa City Public Library, starting in 1977 as a full-time librarian and never leaving. What was it about the Iowa City Public Library that captured you?
Well, I think the first thing I did was fall in love with Iowa City. You know, one of those people who came to school and felt so comfortable here. The way Iowa City, people who live here, you know, talk about issues, debate one another, give their input to all levels of government, get involved in their community, the level of volunteerism. Iowa City was just a fantastic place. I was, you know, newly married, had a baby at that point. It had some of the best schools in the state of Iowa. And it was, you know, a little bit away from where all my relatives were, but not too far, just the right amount. So first I fell in love with Iowa City, and then I started working at the library, and I had the great, great good fortune of working with some fantastic women, you know, a generation or so older than me, and they were such mentors to me, believed so strongly in things that are not quite as ingrained, I don't think, as they are now, you know, the concepts of intellectual freedom and... Yes, you have to buy the stuff you don't like because other people like it, and you have to represent all points of view. You know, concepts that are still people still struggle with, like, yes, children have access to all the materials in the library, and if you're their parent and you don't want that to happen, then you need to come and tell them no, because we're not going to. So just great role models of women who were not only working at the library, but involved in, you know, the fair housing laws that were being written at that time in Iowa City. You know, there was one woman there who was pretty well known around town for starting girls softball because there wasn't anything for girls. And first she tried to get the girls into the boys baseball. And oh my God, the world would end if that happened. And so just great mentors and role models in the women who were working at the Iowa City Public Library at the time.
You've been director since 1994. Let's talk about some of the things that you feel are most important to the mission of the Iowa City Public Library, because that mission has grown and changed over time. And you mentioned, I mean, the card catalog people, that's been gone for a long time.
A long time.
And people, of course, have access to books electronically in so many ways now, too. So let's talk about what you think is most important about a library in a community. What do you think the most important jobs are?
I think the most important things have really not changed that much. How we do it. Maybe you're reading a book electronically, but we still have you know, professional librarians who selected that book for the Iowa City community and bought it with your tax dollars and made it available for you to read or to listen to or whatever, however you consume all of the information that we provide. So providing information that people in your community want and need, we're still doing it. It's just that we're doing it differently. You know, I always say, We were the early childhood literacy center before anyone ever used the phrase early childhood literacy. You know, 50 years ago, public libraries were giving story times and introducing young children to books. I mean, 50 years ago, there weren't preschools and, you know, formalized education for 2-, 3-, and 4-year-olds. The public library was where you went and learned to sit with other people and listen to a story and lose yourself in a book. You know, that's been going on forever, and it's still going on. You know, we still offer children's programs through the library 7 days a week, most weeks. And we do outreach, so we reach out to kids who are in some of those child care situations who don't have the way to get to the library. So early childhood literacy, providing collections, that intellectual freedom component of, yes, whatever you want, we're going to try and have it here for you, and we're going to represent all points of view. And we are a safe place, whatever, you know, whatever your issues are, and whatever T-shirt you wear, whatever political pin you have on, you are welcome at the Iowa City Public Library, and hope everyone feels equally welcome and well served.
The library in many communities, and Iowa City is no exception, is a place where often vulnerable people find a place where they can go to have computer access, to have the support of librarians, but also a warm, quiet place to be as well. How important do you feel like that is for a library?
I think that that is really an essential role in a community, you know, and again, something we've done for decades, it's perhaps more apparent now. But when I was 14 years old and worked at the Waterloo Public Library, everyone who, you know, worked there knew that there was a gentleman who was homeless and lived down by the river in a tent. And he would come and he would often be, he had his chair at the library. And, you know, we said hello to him. And so that's one of the roles that a library plays in the community. I've had many comments over the years from people who were suffering through some kind of personal crisis in their life, whether they just lost a loved one and they needed to be around people, or they lost their job. And again, just getting out and being in a place where if you want to speak to people, you can. And if you don't, you can sit in the corner and just observe. But be in a place that's full of activity and people. You know, you can see the kids walk by, whatever. I think that's a very important role that the library plays in the community.
Iowa City is the United States' first UNESCO City of Literature. And I know that you were involved in those efforts as well. What, reflecting back, why do you think that, what are you proud about with working with the City of Literature?
Well, I think it's a reflection on the community. We are a community of readers, and certainly the, you know, major components of the university, like the writing program and the international writing program, were key to our being selected as a UNESCO City of Literature. But they looked at the broader community as well. They looked at the libraries. They looked at, you know, at that time, I think we had more library cards than we had people who lived in Iowa City. That's since gone down a little bit. But they looked at how many books were circulated per capita. And this is a town where so many people write, and the ones who don't write read, and they contribute to literary efforts, large and small. So it is very appropriate that Iowa City was the first UNESCO City of Literature in the United States.
You've also been involved with the Center for the Book and on the All Iowa Reads Committee
Yes.
for a long time. Tell me a little bit about your work. All Iowa Reads, of course, you select. First, it was one book that Iowans, you know, were recommended to read and arrange opportunities for people to talk about it and interact about it. But that program has expanded so much over time to recommending books for different reading levels and really.
Yes, there's three books now, one for adults, one for teens, upper elementary, and then one for the younger kids. I learned so much participating in that, being on the committee that chose that book. And again, if there could be a UNESCO State of Literature, I think Iowa would be right up there in the running, because people from all kinds of communities, you know, there were college-associated, academic-associated folks on that committee, both from public schools and colleges and universities, large and small public libraries. You know, I had the luxury of being in a larger library that had a pretty significant staff, and I could take a day off once every few months and go to Des Moines for a meeting. And some of these small libraries, they're out there in rural Iowa, staffed by one or two people. And, you know, for one of them to take a day off four or five times a year to go to a committee meeting in Des Moines is really a burden on them. And yet they do it for the love of reading, for the love of community interaction. And I got lots of titles of books I want to read when I retire, too.
So the library has had to deal, I mean, you mentioned being a strong library in a big city. It has had to deal with budget cuts over the years. Make the case for me, for people who think libraries are not as relevant as they used to be. So let's think about all those small towns all over Iowa where it may be really hard to make those budget arguments for the local public library. Why do you think a library is so essential in 2018, 2019?
I look at small town libraries, and they are really the absolute community center of their community. Many small towns have lost their schools. They don't even have an elementary school anymore. The place where people, you know, the coffee, they don't even have a coffee shop maybe. And the place where people come and gather is the public library. The place where their kids who maybe have a computer at their school, but they don't have dependable Wi-Fi at home, either because it's not affordable or because it just doesn't exist. My daughter lived for a while in a fairly rural area of Iowa, and you know, she had Wi-Fi, but it was sort of hit and miss. And but the library has dependable Wi-Fi, so a support network for the students and their use of technology, but also for adults and their use of technology. You know, we talked, you mentioned that as something that is very important that libraries do today. I always say the internet is like the encyclopedia was 30 years ago. That if you were in a home that had an encyclopedia, well, good for you. But many of us, me included, were not. And when you needed an encyclopedia, you went to the library. And that's what libraries do in these small communities, is support programming for children and families, provide technology support, provide access to the internet, and be a community center and the hub of lots of activities and things that are going on in the community.
Well, you officially retire December 28th.
Right.
You've got a long stack of books to read.
Yes, right? A big stack of books.
And what else are you most looking forward to?
I have grandkids in the area, and so I'm already set to babysit on January 3rd and 4th
nice.
When the teacher parents have to go back to school, but the student children are not yet back in school. So that's set up. Looking forward to some volunteer activities I haven't had time to do, and gardening. I'm a gardener.
Susan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And again, congratulations.
Thank you.
Susan Craig, the longtime director of the Iowa City Public Library. She's been director since 1994, a full-time librarian at the library since 1977. She is retiring at the end of this month. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.